Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
God created rich people first, and then showed them the world they would own. And when they came to a field with thousands of headless bodies, with torsos and hands like iron, God told them the headless bodies were destined to be poor workers. The rich cried out, "But these heroes with their iron muscles will crush us." "Don't be frightened," answered God. "I shall place very small heads and brains on their bodies, so until they develop them, you've nothing to fear." Who are still the oppressors? The rich. Who are still the oppressed? The poor. Your slavery is their liberty. Your poverty is their prosperity. Priests say the poor must be content with their poverty and they'll find heaven hereafter. Idiots, cretinous rag pickers. My dog George has more sense. Don't you know that whilst you're gazing up at heaven, your pockets are being picked clean, your eyes are plucked out, and you're robbed of your birthright, blind to what is done to you? Christ's priests seized mankind in its cradle and broke the bad news, saying, you shapeless stench, you can never be anything but filth. Your only chance of winning a pardon for being so filthy is if you bow low in perfect humility in the face of all the afflictions, sorrows, and injustices heaped upon you. You're poor, and you stay poor. That is how it is meant to be. Life is a bitter ordeal. Don't speak out. Just try and save your worthless soul. You won't be able to, but you'll give us less trouble by trying. And when the time comes for you to die croaking, the darkness will be as hard to bear as the daylight ever was. The church knows its business. It offers fear and punishment, not happiness, certainly not liberty, only servitude, forever and forever. Religion is a liar and a cheat. Yet still you hunger for it. That's why you've sent for me. Jacques Roux, Mad Jacques, Red Roux, preacher of the poor, sower of sedition, subverter of all laws, a priest who saw the light of reason and now proclaims fellowship with all who live in dark dens and desolate places. It's fitting that I should preach perhaps my last sermon in a ruined church in the parish of St. Nicholas, Summer's End. I go before the tribunal tomorrow, charged with revolutionary excess. Now I am, it seems, too revolutionary for the revolution, and so it begins. When power rested in one man, King Louis, all sorts complained of oppression, and the nobility, middle, and moneyed men called on the poor to help. Together, we lopped off that top branch of tyranny, but the tree still stands and spreads. New branches hide the sun of freedom from the poor. The Revolutionary Tribunal is one such. I don't recognize its authority to judge me. Only the poor of St. Nicholas can do that. I come here to lay the rags and tatters of my life before my peers. Habits are hard to break, citizens. I come to confess me. Hear my confession. Do not forgive me, Father, for I have not sinned. My own father had 12 children, and as I was the cleverest, he rid himself of me by sending me to school at the Angoulême Seminary. At 15, I was ordained a priest when I knew even less about God than I know now. There was a priest on every dunghill. The scummier they were, the more they sprouted. But I stayed on and became professor of philosophy, teaching students to bear with fortitude the misfortunes of others. Like religion, philosophy solves the problems of the past and the future, never the present. In 79, the Angoulême students rioted over the agony they saw around them and killed a cook by accident. As a suspect teacher with ideas, I was arrested and imprisoned, though I had nothing to do with the incident. A month or so later, I was released. No trial, no inquiry. Authority had decreed it, and I had no say in the matter whether I was to be free or in chains. This is how fires are kindled. Afterwards, I spent 4 years in the chair of experimental medicine at Angoulême, but medicine proved equally useless. Physicians know even less than philosophers and priests gangrened together. They lie. They all lie. Isn't that so, Georges? You tell him. I've grown hoarse in the telling. In 89, I was given this poor parish of St. Nicholas, and I was born into the real world of starvation and misery, and I saw the horror and the hope, too, for the revolution burst over us, smashed the clamps that held us down, and swept us up, up, with its transforming power. We opened the book we'd never read, and on the first page was the word liberty. Listen. Listen, the revolution was born in violence. Revolutions must be violent. It is the only way to end the greater violence that keeps the majority of mankind in servitude. Do you think that those with privileges would give them up without a fight because you have a charming smile and the best arguments? Adjura, adjura. I renounced my alliance to Rome and gave it to France. I became a constitutional priest, put off the mitred robes of privilege and put on the white robes of liberty. I still practice as priest and physician when called on, but I have to earn an honest living as a pamphleteer and municipal official. I live with a good woman widow petted, born Elizabeth Hubert, once laundress to the rich, now my helpmate, soulmate, who sells my pamphlets, 2 sous a copy. We adopted a son, Emile, a sweet, sweet boy. No more of that. Not for your ears, or yours, or yours. My only fear, citizens, is not of death, but of a life without them. George knows. We love them, don't we, George, eh? I was elected a member of the commune and spoke for the poor. I told Robespierre, Saint-Just, Brissot, and the rest that they could never be the revolution, just men, and not to be trusted with power. Anyone with authority becomes an oppressor, a parasitic coat of filth on the hide of the common people. Between those who command and those who obey, there is only hate. Does it follow that I reject all authority? No, but I always keep my hat on in its presence. In the matter of bread, I consult a baker. In the matter of boots, a bootmaker. A house, a builder. For special knowledge, I apply to a specialist. But I don't allow the baker, the bootmaker, or the builder to impose their authority over me. I listen to them with the respect they merit, if any, but I keep the right to judge, criticize, and censure. Why should we treat politicians of whatever stripe, royal or revolutionary, any different? I listen to King Louis, Mirabeau, Lafayette, the same way I listen to the baker and the bootmaker. Don't be fooled by those who set themselves above you. Always look at the bill they are presenting. You have to pay it. And criticize me, too. People thought Citizen Marat and I were enemies because we were forever attacking each other. He called me an extremist, this from a man who declared 300,000 heads weren't enough. But we were never enemies, just revolutionaries doing our duty. Neither of us were popular with the legislators, but it's not my purpose to be popular. I'm here to sting. To stop me stinging, the Assembly hired me to write the report of the King's execution. We didn't do that well, but you'll not squeeze one tear from my eye over the fate of a royal fool and his followers who talked of honour and died without it. To the boneyard with the whole crew, the rich we'll gobble up, tra-lee, tra-la, tra-la, with truffles in the rump and oysters on each eye. I love the harp. That's how men and women should die. To the sound of harps, they're so precious. King Louis died to the sound of drums. As the recording officer, I went with Citizen Santerre to the Temple prison to escort the king to the place of execution. Santerre brought a carriage and a guard of honor for the occasion. We drove through streets lined with citizens. They had 3 executioners waiting, 3 and 18 drummers. What extravagance is just to kill one man. The knife fell. Louis' head fell with it. The crowd shouted, "Long live the Republic!" And then I saw Citizen Santerre and the other revolutionary officials dipping their handkerchiefs in the king's blood. I wrote it all up in my report, but I was the only one who seemed disgusted by the whole spectacle. Invading armies were about to overwhelm Paris. There was civil strife in the Vendée, rebellions in Lyon and Bordeaux, and good men and women were dying everywhere defending the revolution, even as the traitorous Louis was dying on the scaffold. But the good and the true had no carriages, no 18 drummers and 3 executioners. A Prussian sword in the belly, an English bullet in the chest, and falling face down in the mud was their end. That's how ordinary people die. Meanly, without harps or even drums to play them out, that Louis, that useless toe-rag of a man, goes in style as anemic blood gathered up as something precious. A month later, remember, I led the attack on the Paris food merchants. I'm proud of that attack. Those in power condemn me for it, so I know it must have been right. We ask only for food, a home, a little ease, no more crying in the streets. Bread, bread, for God's sake. We were at war. But so we accepted such hardships if they were equally shared. But they weren't. We were dying because of filthy bourgeois graft and greed. The slimy, rapacious, money-mad exploiters were hoarding food to raise the price on the open market. Legislators wrung their hands, threatened with a whisper, and did nothing. So we flat bellies marched, smashed stalls, broke open shops and warehouses and found the bread and meat and other foodstuffs they'd hidden in abundance. They asked us why we did it. We told them because we needed it. Citizen Marat said we should kill every merchant in sight. We may do with a few score strung up in front of their own shops to encourage the others. And it did. The next morning the food markets were filled again with fruit and vegetables, bread and meat. Like Jesus, we had performed the miracle of the loaves and fishes. We must appropriate the land and money from the rich who have it in excess and give it to those who need it and live in want. The only way to defend and save the revolution is by pushing it as far as it'll go and then further, and that's never far enough for me. Then Citizen Marat died. Steel through the heart, painless, when he'd had such a painful life. I miss him. No one left to trust. That's why I agreed to become editor of his paper when his staff asked me to keep the bright flame burning. So when those impotent, excremental conformists, Robespierre and the Jacobin gang, banned women from political power, we took up the cause. They wanted liberty for themselves alone. I wrote that those refugees from the leper house of reaction should be belled and booted headfirst into the nearest sewer. In return, they persuaded Marat's widow Catherine to denounce me to the revolutionary tribunal for besmirching her husband's memory. Poor sweet Catherine, grief takes many forms. She wanted to protect her husband's fame. She thought I was trying to take it from him in some way. I shun fame. It always costs too much. Late last night, I went walking through the streets of Paris with Georges. Just the two of us. Georges padding beside me, sniffing every post and doorway, and me smoking my pipe. Oh, there's nothing better. Making love, perhaps. Or making a revolution. But with a revolution, you have to be right. It was a clear night. And empty streets, and as we passed St. Nicholas's church, something strange happened. I was walking, but suddenly I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Not one. Silence. I was a dead man walking. No more of that. Tomorrow, before the tribunal of mumblers, I shall make no attempt to defend myself. That doesn't mean to say I'll stay silent. Never that. I'll do what I was born to do. Attack. If the verdict of that bunch of rotting fishheads goes against me, I die like friend Marat, though struck down by a better hand. My own. Been a rich confession after all, friends, deserving of some penance, at least 5 Hail Marys and 26 Amens. After all, I've preached revolution and sedition, slaughtered a king and others, lived in sin, and will probably end even deeper in it by killing myself. In the eyes of the church, it is a 100% record of failure. But on Judgment Day, I expect to stand before my God justified. I do not condemn myself and shall not be condemned. So, amen. If it's to be the last amen, I go gladly. My wife and son will weep, I know. And Georges here will howl a little, won't you, boy? My friends will pause and shake their heads and move on. For they have the difficult part. Living well is so much harder than dying well. I have tried to help create a people who are skeptical, rational, critical, not easily fooled or impressed, in a word, a free people, ungovernable. It's a dream, of course, but I've been lucky to have lived through times that made the dream seem possible, when just for a moment we stopped being me and mine, you and yours, us and them, and saw ourselves instead as equals in our common humanity. We are of that generation that so transformed the world that future days and nights can never be the same. We poor, clumsy men and women turned the world upside down, inside out, round and about. One last word from my last sermon. The revolution isn't complete, hardly begun. Defend it. Don't sit back. Act. Without action, no life. Without life, no perfection. Without perfection, no eternal peace and freedom. For God is an active power. And we do his work in fighting the great battles. Light against darkness. Love against selfishness. Revolution against reaction. Life against death. Come on, Joe. Time for our walk.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Handsome Furs with Serve the People. And before that, in the long introduction, of course, I didn't talk at all at the beginning of the show tonight. I felt Alan Rickman could do it better, frankly. I mean, that was his performance of The Preacher, about the revolutionary, early socialist, Jacques Roux, who was active in the 1790s during the French Revolution. And that was the one act play that, that was written by Peter Barnes, a British playwright, and, that Alan Rickman actually performed on, BBC in 1989. And it's pretty, it's just classic, you know, someone's just got to play it. And I think it's, given the kind of things that are going on right now, especially with the US election and whatnot, I think it was a pretty appropriate thing to play. Anyways, I mean, I don't really can say I have maybe the best, I don't feel equipped maybe to give the maybe the best analysis of the situation here tonight. So what I'm going to do is in the next segment of the show, I'm going to turn it over to Sean Blackman of who's a African-American socialist. And he did a pretty amazing interview earlier this week on Breakthrough News with Eugene Puryear. And where he talked about this situation in the American election and gave a pretty brilliant analysis from a black socialist perspective. So I'm going to play that right now. And he just knocks it out of the park. It's amazing. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We're happy to be joined by Sean Blackman, host of the U.S. DC-based radio show By Any Means Necessary, and a longtime friend and comrade in the movement to me and Eugene. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Thank you both so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. The Sean Blackman, I'll say. We really brought you on because I know you're on the air in Kansas City. We need that Midwest demo. So
we brought you explain.
Sean, I really appreciate you joining us. I mean, there's so much to be said here. There's a lot that's been said on this show. You know, I maybe want to kind of start with where we started the show on, talking to Breonna Joy Gray, former National Press Secretary of the Bernie Sanders campaign. This will, of course, rest on our social media and YouTube. Definitely check it out. See what she had to say. Fantastic stuff. On some of how we parse the election results and some of the issues that I brought up that are issues I know are known to you, Sean. You know, the fact that there were fewer votes, for instance, for Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton in places like Philadelphia, like Detroit, like the majority black counties of North Carolina, like the black belt counties of Alabama, which I know you're very familiar with. And you know, looking at all of this, what does it really say about the way the Democrats ran the campaign and who they really value and what sort of those communities that are talked about so much rhetorically, the black community, young people, and so on and so forth, really have to expect, or should they be expecting?
Yeah, well, when you point out the way that the vote rolled out in places like Alabama, I mean, I'm just reminded of when in recent years, a UN rapporteur went to Alabama and said it was the worst poverty it had seen in the developed world. And I mean, Alabama is my ancestral home. I mean, my folks literally picked cotton there, and the poverty is so deep. And when we look at other material issues, like 10 million people with the coronavirus infected, 1 million people, another million folks filed for unemployment last week. And what does the Biden and Kamala Harris administration have to say or to offer as a solution to these and so many other issues? Precisely nothing. I mean, the big goose egg. And so when you talk about who it is that the Democratic Party is really playing to, I mean, I don't think it can be overemphasized when Joe Biden told that group of donors that nothing will fundamentally change. This was him soothing the conscience of wealthy donors and the ruling class, which he is very much a part of, that he won't go the ways of those big, scary socialists like Bernie Sanders or progressives like Elizabeth Warren and people like this. And so from the campaign trail to the calling of the election for Biden, all the way until we get to the inauguration day, what the Democrats have shown is they are very much a party of the ruling class, a party of the wealthy, a party of the bosses who do not have any real answers or solutions for the masses of poor working and oppressed people. He wants to shoot protesters and give cops more money. And in truth, just like the Republicans, Democrats are sworn to protect the capitalist system, out of which all these issues and ills for the masses of folks in this country suffer from.
I just want to note here, when you watch the replay, Sean, the booth went rogue a little bit there, noting your Florida origins. Of course, I have nothing negative to say about the state of Florida, never said anything negative about the state of Florida or the city of Pensacola, of which is your home. But, you know, Florida man is a meme. That's all you can really say. But, no, I really appreciate the points that you're making here. I mean, I think it's extraordinary. I mean, in some way, well, I don't know if it is extraordinary, I guess. When, you know, we used to talk about this all the time, on by any means necessary. Is it extraordinary or just outrageous, or how do we parse that? And I think that's a whole other issue. But, I mean, just the palpable reality that there is a deepening, I don't know, cleavage, divide, whatever you want to say, between Democratic elites and Democrat and, you know, Black communities. It reminds me of something, and we talked about this a little bit earlier on the show too. Monica brought this up. Representative Jim Clyburn, his just completely ridiculous comment saying, "I've been Black my whole life and I've never known any Black people that were sympathetic to socialism." I mean, not only do I think that that's just completely false, I mean, I just wonder what you think it does. And maybe it doesn't have that big of an impact because younger people aren't affected by these things. But that kind of messaging, what sort of impact does it really have on the nature and the direction of, you know, this centuries-long Black liberation struggle?
Yeah, you know, it really is a shame, Eugene and Monica. Old Grandpappy Jim is going out sad, man. He's going out sad. He represents a completely outmoded and outdated form of Black politic that is completely based on kowtowing to the mostly white Democrat party establishment. I mean, this cat said that the phrase "burn, baby, burn" is how they, quote, lost the movement in the 60s. Not COINTELPRO, not J. Edgar Hoover, not the full brunt of the racist capitalist state coming down upon them. Just those few words. But, you know, I was just reading earlier today about how Jim Clyburn had, over the last decade, has taken over $1 million from pharmaceutical companies, far outpacing his peers. And when we look at the fact that Pfizer is now being looked upon to, you know, crank out this treatment for the coronavirus, a company which itself has a gross history of price gouging with AIDS treatments and things like that. And, you know, I mean, Jim Clyburn is making these statements with a picture of W.E.B. Du Bois behind him. The same Du Bois that was in the Communist Party when he died, you feel me? And was very open about how politically bankrupt the two-party system is in this country between the Democrats and Republicans. And so, you know, he's talking about how sloganeering is killing people. He really said that. And when he says sloganeering, what is he talking about? He's talking about defund the police, healthcare for all. He thinks that sloganeering somehow kills more people than, oh, I don't know, the police or these pharmaceutical companies that put people's health to the whims of a corporate profit like Pfizer and those folks who gave him $1 million over the past 10 years. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. And this notion that these progressive phraseology and measures like defunding and healthcare for all somehow is the reason why Democrats lost seats, even though no one who lost a seat was really running on these platforms, if memory serves, I think means a couple of things. I think it goes to show just how out of touch the Democratic establishment leadership is with Black folks on the one hand. And I also think it signals another incoming assault on not only the progressive wing of the Democrat Party, as embodied by folks like Bernie and the Squad and people like this. I think it will also mean an attack on more left-leaning, maybe more socialist or communist-leaning elements outside of the Democratic Party as well. Because we've seen the orientation of the Democrat Party to the movement in the streets. I talked about how old Joe wants to shoot protesters and give the cops more money. But Democratic governors and mayors across this country sicked their police on demonstrators like rabid dogs. I mean, Muriel Bowser here in D.C., a so-called progressive, wants to take $43 million from healthcare and employment services to give to police for overtime for protesting. She wants to defund the people's needs to reward the cops for their organized thuggery. And if that isn't looting, man, I just don't know what is.
Sean. I mean, I couldn't have said it better. You spoke to so many issues so well. And to note, it is true that every single congressperson who ran on a Medicare for All platform retained or switched their seat, won that seat. And so goes for, the same goes for the Green New Deal. Those who support the Green New Deal also, I think it was some 99% won their seat. So it's very clear that a progressive agenda is a winning agenda. And I just want to posit another question to you, the same question that I asked Kofi Hunt earlier, political director with the SEIU Division for Fast Food Workers and a fighter in the fight for 15 in Florida, a lot of F-sir. But really just the contradictions we saw laid bare with the elections in Florida last week. We have Amendment 2 for a $15 dollars an hour minimum wage, winning more votes, getting 60% of the vote, which was more votes than Biden or Trump won. And but at the same time, the Democrats in Florida losing 5 seats in the House. And like I said, I put this out to Kofi to really talk about this unity that we see on working class issues. We talk so much about, you know, the racial divide in this country. People talk about Trump igniting a class a race war. But what I would like to say is I think it really looks like a class war, as you spoke so well too. So what do you really think is the best way forward for this movement to really unite the needs of, you know, Black, Latino, and white workers in a state like Florida, and what that means overall for the entire nation?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, because when we look at the character of Joe Biden's victory, it's clear that it wasn't out of some, you know, deep enthusiasm for Joe Biden as a candidate and as an individual. I mean, he is thoroughly uninspiring as a person. And in terms of what the movement must do, I think the movement must recognize the sort of class character of what we're seeing in the streets, what we're seeing across the country, what we're seeing for the tens of millions of people who didn't vote at all because they're so disaffected from this system, and begin to see that it is, in fact, that class basis that unites us, and that it is, in fact, the capitalist system that is the overriding culprit, the booger bear, like they say back home, that is impacting us all. You know what I mean? And so it is the ruling class. It is open bigots like Trump and ruling class ne'er-do-wells like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. They are the ones who benefit from us being divided amongst each other and split up with this divide and conquer thing, with race, religion, gender, sexuality, and all these other things. And so the only way to sort of overcome this is to mirror what, you know, the Panthers did with the original Rainbow Coalition back in the 60s, you know, with, you know, the young lords and the young patriots and the American Indian movement, recognizing that the forms of oppression and exploitation that we experience are not the same, but that they flow from the same system, and that ultimately we have to attack the system if we want to win, because attacking each other will only lead to a devastating loss.
You know, Sean, we've talked quite a bit here, not just in this conversation, but really tonight, on so many of the implications for a Biden win, or at least what appears to be a Biden win in lieu of whatever Trump may or may not do. And I know you're there in D.C. where they're saying they're going to gather this weekend, these supporters of Trump.
MAGA Man March.
The Million MAGA March. I mean, the only thing I can say about that is that the, and I think you'll appreciate this, Sean, the cultural relevance of the Million Man March, just consistently, that now even MAGA is using that imagery, says something in and of itself. And if you want to speak to that, I think that's very relevant, and I think deeply important in terms of the history of the Black Liberation Movement in America. But, you know, slightly shifting narratives. Internationally, obviously, there are huge implications of any U.S. president. And I think this is one of the areas where, I mean, certainly people are hoping for some big changes, and whether they will or whether they won't, I don't know. I think there's some people out there who are thinking, well, who's Biden going to bomb next? So, you know, who knows exactly what will happen here. But I wonder just your evaluation of whether or not this election represents any sort of shift, palpable shift maybe, in terms of what the general orientation of U.S. actions abroad will be.
Well, Eugene, Monica, I'm so glad y'all raised this, because to answer that question, all we have to look at are the people that Biden is trying to bring on for his foreign policy part of his cabinet. I mean, we're talking about people like Susan Rice and Michael Flournoy and Nicholas Burns and Samantha Powers. I mean, these are Russia hawks and China hawks and people who were supporters and major players in U.S. aggression in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. I mean, Susan Rice helped plunge Libya into a failed state with open air slave markets. And one of the wildest things about this campaign season is that the Democrats are to the right of Donald Trump on certain foreign policy points, on China, on Venezuela and Cuba, on North Korea. I mean, when Donald Trump is to the left of you on anything, you have seriously lost the plot. So what we can expect from a Biden presidency on the international front is a more consistent, a more polite, and a more genteel presentation of U.S. imperialism, but U.S. imperialism nonetheless. And we shouldn't forget that Joe Biden was vice president under the man who expended drone warfare, Barack Obama. I mean, we know what happened with Yemen and all those sorts of things. And so I think we can expect much the same from Joe Biden. I don't think we're going to see any kind of progressive move on the international front. And so when I talked about that mass movement that we have to develop earlier, there has to be, I think, a strong anti-imperialist strain within that movement to make a connection to the struggling people across the globe outside of the U.S. Borders to strike a collective blow against the global ruling class that is just sucking the blood and breaking the backs of the people across this planet who work and toil and labor to generate the wealth that is hoarded by the wealthy minority.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Blackman, you are preaching right now. I really couldn't, neither of us could say that any better. We really appreciate your just solid synthesis of all these issues. And further on this question of foreign policy, we have a question from Twitter for you. So with elections coming in less than 1 month in Venezuela, attacks on the Bolivian Republic from the U.S. are expected to intensify. Will the Biden admin continue the legacy of sanctions and attacks started by Obama? What are your thoughts, Sean?
Oh, without question. And matter of fact, just a few days ago, Nicolas Maduro, the democratically elected president of Venezuela, basically gave a warning about some impending attack on Venezuela. We know about the numerous attempts at a failed coup in Venezuela directed by the United States with its handpicked puppet would-be leader Juan Guaido, a fake, a fraud, and a failure, just some random dude they plucked out of obscurity to try to lead this thing. And what's been interesting to see is as that coup attempt sort of, you know, crumbled, and as it was clear that Guaido wouldn't be successful, I mean, the right opposition in Venezuela just became more and more and more split. And so I think that that puts the PSUV, the ruling party in Venezuela, in a pretty good position to continue to move forward. But the fact of the PSUV likely remaining in power, I think, means an intensified sanctions campaign against Venezuela. And so, unfortunately, I think for the people of Venezuela, things will likely get worse before they get any better under a Biden administration.
You know, it's a good point. I just wonder your thoughts here, Sean, when you look at this level of seemingly unthinking aggression against countries like Venezuela, like Cuba, is it a threat of a bad example? I mean, what's really behind this behavior that's having such a devastating impact?
Well, that's a great question, because we have to ask ourselves, you know, why does the United States government treat an island nation like Cuba like it's some kind of existential threat? It isn't. And the same thing with Venezuela. Speaking of Barack Obama, who put, you know, Venezuela on a list of, terrorist countries. It's because these countries have progressive, socialist-oriented governments that do an incredible job of taking care of its people, even amidst the criminal unilateral sanctions aimed at it by the United States. I mean, not that long ago, Nicolas Maduro, Venezuelan president, announced a very effective coronavirus treatment that they're going to present to the World Health Organization that they want to share with the world. But, you know, we here in the United States will have to pay dearly when there is a COVID-19 vaccine. I mentioned earlier about the danger of having a major corporation like Pfizer be at the head of it. Meanwhile, when Donald Trump was diagnosed with coronavirus, he was able to avail himself of the latest medicines and technologies completely free of charge. Okay. And so he talked, you know, Trump talked about not letting the coronavirus impact your life. Well, for those of us that aren't alleged billionaires and don't have the benefit of having a presidential paycheck, it absolutely is something that is going to impact our lives in a number of levels. And so this is why the United States is not only attacking Cuba and Venezuela, but why it pushes back so fiercely against the ideas of socialism and communism, and why it makes anti-communism almost like an unofficial religion in this country. And so when we see that the capitalist system is exploitative by its very nature, is racist by its very nature, then I think we have to look very seriously about what kind of society that we need and how we can go about organizing for a society that is based on the sustenance and the development of your humanity instead of the maximization of profit. And it looks to me anyway, like that kind of system looks something like what we see in Cuba and Venezuela and other parts of the socialist world that have done so well under the coronavirus, while we still got quite a ways to go here in the wealthiest country on earth.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think we may have another tweet coming up here. How do you all think the Democrats will react to the Black Lives Matter movement now that Biden has won? Sean Blackman, your thoughts?
Man, I mean, they're going to react to it like they're reacting to it right now. Complete repression and condemnation and trafficking in this good protester, bad protester narrative. I mean, look at how Joe Biden and Kamala Harris responded to the racist police killing of Walter Wallace Jr. in Philadelphia. They're like, oh, you know, his Black life mattered and yada, yada. And it's, you know, whatever. Basically, they're the liberal version of thoughts and prayers. Right. But then right after that, they immediately qualified and say, you know, however, that was that. But that it's not an excuse for violence. And they even tried to invoke Dr. King. And they said that, you know, violence doesn't bend the moral arc of the universe towards justice. And so this is a man who is dead. We're talking about human life, because when they're talking about violence, they're not talking about racist police terror against human beings. They're not talking about the political suppression of free speech rights. They're talking about people committing violent acts against property, inanimate objects. But again, when we understand that the Democrats, or ruling class party that is sworn to protect the system of capitalism, we know that they value property more than human life. This is why Joe Biden wants to give more money to the police, because the police's chief function in a capitalist system is to serve the interests of the ruling class and to protect their property. So this is why, you know, Joe Biden, Democrats will never call for the defunding the police or the demilitarization of the police, because them being militarized and them having all of these funds and resources is integral to their role as the armed wing of the vicious capitalist state.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, Sean. You know, the viewer, watcher, I don't know what we call people on the internet, and I appreciate the question asked all of us. I mean, what are some of your thoughts here about what the Democrats will do? Is Sean right?
For sure. This is something we've spoken so much on. Before I get into this, I just want to throw out there, as a Black Puerto Rican, I have a particular gripe against Pfizer and Big Pharma coming to our homeland, you know, to use our beautiful natural resources. Of course, the U.S. military using the island of Vieques as just a playground for their bombs and bullets. So I definitely had to throw that in there, but just throw back to your answer a couple of questions ago. But I mean, this is something that I've said all throughout the summer of the uprising. You know, when we were doing live streams every single week here at Breakthrough, you know, it's really astounding to me, you know, to see people's, you know, let's talk about Black people's blood. Let's talk about people who are protesting, okay, on these Black Lives Matter plazas that, you know, you spoke, D.C. Mayor Mario Bowser was so excited to put up there, get her photo op in. You know, we saw that when Mayor de Blasio here in New York City and Chicago, all around the country, right? And literally videos of these cops beating, arresting, shooting tear gas canisters, you know, using LRAD against protesters, you know, literally about to burst people's ears eardrums, you know, on Black Lives Matter Plaza. So, you know, I think it just goes to show that, you know, symbolism can only go so far, and it doesn't really mean crap when at the end of the day, the policies and the repression and the actions of these Democratic mayors who, I love how you said that, the thoughts and prayers, you know, type rhetoric, that's not going to save nobody. That's not going to change anyone's life. That's not going to save anyone's life. And I think really what we're seeing when we look at a movement against police brutality, a movement demanding an end to racist and violent policing, be met with the same kind of brutality from the very force it's hitting the streets to stand up against. I mean, that just reveals something so fundamental to what you spoke to, Sean, what the capitalist state really is and the kind of repression that is necessary to continue to shut down the resistance. But I mean, it works in a twofold way, right? The more we see this resistance in the streets, the more repression we're going to see. And I think the lessons that you spoke to, Sean, of the 60s and 70s really speak to that as well. We saw Black and brown people being organized in a way, being politicized in a way that they never had been before in history. The Rainbow Coalition, the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, of course, again, with the symbol, you know, the symbolism we see nowadays, everyone thinks it's cool. Okay, put on the you pose up with the gun with the, on the, what was it, the wicker chair, famous picture of Huey Newton, you know, and it's just like, these images really don't mean anything at the end of the day when time and time again, Black people are expected to come out for Democrats who are not really doing anything for us at all. You know, where we see a lot of people excited to see someone like Kamala Harris, you know, the self-proclaimed top cop of California. I mean, the second largest incarcerator of people in this entire country. So when we're really talking about what it means when it comes to Black liberation, national liberation, also tying in these international issues with the struggle here at home, we really need to talk about the inherent violence of this system. And all this talk about violence irritates me because to me, poverty is violence. Homelessness is violence. Hunger is violence. A lack of jobs is violence. People having to work until their 80s because they can't, they don't have a pension or they can't afford to save for retirement. That's violence to me. I'm going off right now.
No, it's all relevant. And I mean, everything you're saying is 100% true. I mean, I agree with both of you. You know, we're maybe just reinforcing some of these important points. I mean, I'm so glad, Sean, that you brought up the issue of the Philadelphia thing and what Biden said, because it was unprompted. It wasn't like they were like, well, what do you think that somebody broke into a store? It was just like, what do you just generally think about this person being killed by police? You did not have to say anything. But the fact that you chose to basically like lead with this, like, oh, it's terrible, but don't do anything that, you know, I wouldn't like, or what, I don't even know, it's a ridiculous thing. But I mean, his earlier statement, and I think you mentioned this as well, that, you know, anarchists and arsonists deserve to be prosecuted. Well, you know, I'm not an anarchist, I'm a socialist, but at the end of the day, I don't think that someone should be criminalized for their ideological predilections. And I think that it is deeply problematic and, quite frankly, Trump-like to have this sort of posture. And I think we've seen the Democrats in this effort to show, no, we love the cops killing people too. I mean, just in the context of every time Biden is asked about this, he says, and he said it in the last debate with Donald Trump, he says, most cops are good. Every police union in the country had endorsed Donald Trump. And that's why Trump's response in the debate was, yeah, well, what cops are backing you? And I thought it was just so unbelievably transparent because, of course, no one who, you know, is all on the back the blue, thin blue line, Blue Lives Matter train was ever going to vote for Joe Biden anyway. But the fact that they feel they need to genuflect towards this, to adopt the rhetoric of it, to really speak to those who are motivated by the most sort of racist motivations. And then you look at a state like Georgia where 54% of voters told CNN and the exit polls that they believe Black Lives Matter. I don't believe that former Vice President Biden, President-elect Biden, got 54% of the votes. So that means some of these people that you claim could never be reached by this messaging of Black Lives Matter have indeed been reached by it and are, in fact, motivated by it. And it's just so indicative. It reminds me when in the 2016 campaign, when Keith Lamont Scott was killed, and there were many protests there, and it was in the news that Hillary Clinton wanted to go and was like, I'm going to go there, I'm going to make a statement. And the Democratic mayor of Charlotte called her and said, please don't come. because they were worried that her bringing a presidential candidate in would galvanize people and that that would take the situation out of their control. I think it says everything you need to know, that in the midst of an election year with an issue that, you know, could have helped them in the state of North Carolina, they would rather demobilize the black community. And then people might wonder, why did every majority black county in North Carolina lose votes for Joe Biden? Well, there you go. And you know, one thing I wanted to just sort of pitch back to you, Sean, and I think it's relevant, and Breonna Joy Gray brought this up earlier in terms of what people were hearing on the ground. I mean, I feel like it's almost treated in a flip way, the record of Joe Biden and the impact of it. And people saying, well, you just have to look past it. It's not a big deal. And look, he won the election. He's in there now. So, you know, whatever. But I do think in the context of people who are going to be demonized, there's no doubt about it. Those narratives are going to come out. People who didn't vote, people voted less, whatever it may be. But, you know, if you live in, you know, the 53206 zip code in Milwaukee, where fewer people voted, which is the number one zip code in America per capita for people incarcerated, it makes sense to me you might be cool on Joe Biden. And we could go on and on looking at these things. But, I mean, just talk to the importance of these things in the record, because I do feel, I mean, and I'm sure you saw this, Sean, you know, the three young women who just a couple weeks before the election, they, I think they were on CNN, and it was like, they were black women. It was like, why are you guys thinking about not voting? And they brought up the crime bill and these other things, and the comments are just people ripping them as if it's somehow illegitimate to take the record of Biden seriously.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I'd like to mention, and maybe this is an aside, but Kamala Harris, not only the top cop of California who built her career throwing black people in jail, also a graduate of Howard University.
Now, so we're going there. Okay. You know, but whatever y'all got to do at FAMU to feel good, I understand that. I'm with it. It's okay.
I'm just saying, first Omarosa, now Kamala. That's all I'm saying. Okay. But
I don't even know any FAMU grads, so I don't know what to tell you.
Well, I mean, Keisha Lance Bottoms, but anyway. But,
well, see, you're not helping yourself. You started out strong, but okay.
Exactly. That don't even help. But yeah, you know, a couple of things based on what you said. I mean, Monica was talking about the repression of protests, and that's so important. Like, when we look at Philadelphia and how they are attacking organizers like Ant Smith, or if we look at anti-racist organizers in Denver, Colorado, who were swept up in a coordinated assault. That was Joel Ibrahim, Eliza Lucero, and Lillian House. I mean, these are people, and we could look at other examples across the country, who are now facing serious prison time potentially. And a lot of times on trumped up charges that are obviously things that are meant to sort of target them because of their protests, not because of anything that they actually did. And to really send a signal that you better not, you know, try to challenge the status quo. You better not try to push back against racist police terror and the complete failure of elected officials, some of them Democratic, who absolutely refuse to do anything about it. And so, yeah, when we talk about sort of this like the vote shaming that you were talking about, I mean, it's so tiresome because we see it every single election cycle. People, you know, the Democrats put up some whack, milquetoast, middle of the road person who's offering absolutely nothing that will be beneficial to people's material conditions. And people are then told that you have to support this person because they're going to help us get rid of the boogeyman or the big bad, whoever that is this time around, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's George W. Bush, whether it's, you know, Mitt Romney or whatever and what have you. And if you don't do that, if this person loses, it is your fault. It's not the fault of the Democratic establishment for not putting up someone who can actually, you know, win or be able to bring people out. So it's not a problem to get people to vote. It's your individual fault. And so it's, you know, it's drilled into our consciousness that we shouldn't ask for things that we want and actually need. People aren't being petulant children for wanting health care or for wanting their loans forgiven, or for wanting to pull some of the ridiculous amount of money to the police to go into some of these sort of things that we need. These are talking points and narratives that are sent by a party, the Democrats, who are not a part of the working class. They are not a part of the masses of exploited people who break their backs to generate this wealth that they don't get to enjoy. And so it's like this kind of falsified consciousness. And folks get to thinking that the concerns of the Democratic Party are their concerns, but they're not. Joe Biden ain't gonna miss no meals. Mm. Kamala Harris doesn't have to worry about where her health care is coming from. You know, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, they don't have to choose between medicine and food or paying rent. Our government is a government for the wealthy. And that's true for Democrats and Republicans. And so what is clear is that the Democrats as an institution will continue to take their base for granted. And as such, I think all they're doing is sort of intensifying this disaffection that we're seeing. But I think that that actually presents an opportunity, because what that presents an opportunity for is for this mass movement that we need to be able to build and grow and to be able to show, like, look, you're not going to be able to vote your way to a lot of these things that you need and that you want and that you've been screaming from the rooftops that you need since, you know, time immemorial. The Democrats have nothing for you. And I would argue that that's actually a kind of subtext for the movement that we've seen in the streets so far this year. Yes, the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were egregious and gross and criminal. But on top of all of that, there was also this distinct feeling that the American people had been abandoned under the coronavirus pandemic. I talked earlier about how last week another million people filing for unemployment. The wealthiest country on earth made a conscious decision that it would rather people get sick and die before it support people to a, you know, a substantive in a substantive way. You know what I mean? And so this all emerges out of the capitalist system. And so this is why I say that as a movement continues to build and as a movement continues to grow, because it hasn't stopped since it began. And do we realize that the movement has continued not only despite state violence ordered from the White House, from different mayors and governors across the country, Republican and Democrat, but even that of racist vigilantes at some of these demonstrations that have driven their cars into people, although police have been doing that too, like the NYPD. But even if we look at a Kenosha where, you know, a young racist militia member murdered two people the very next day after that murdered people were back out in the streets. Okay. Just like here in Washington, D.C., when Donald Trump sent military troops to clear people off of Black Lives Matter Plaza. And I was there when it happened. I saw it. They lied about it, but I saw it with my own eyes. People came back the very next day. So if people are not cowed by state violence and racist vigilante violence and the refusal of this government to support them during this pandemic, well, my goodness, I mean, I feel like there's all the potential in the world to build the kind of force that is needed to not only defeat the refusal of this government to take care of its people, but to defeat the system that is impacting us all, you know, throughout all these different myriad ways.
Well, Sean Blackman of By Any Means Necessary. Fantastic show that you are the co-host of, where people can check you out. Thank you so much for joining us here on Breakthrough News.
Thank you.